Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development Finance and Policy Committee. Today, we have to we do have a quorum in the House, so thank you very much for making it here, members. We have minutes to look at, to approve from our meeting that was yesterday, February 11th. Representative Mecklen, have you had a chance to review the minutes, and do you have a motion for me?
I have reviewed the minutes, Chair, and I would move the minutes from yesterday.
Members, any comments, changes to the minutes from yesterday? If hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? That motion carries. Today, members, this is an important kind of a, again, just a sort of setting us up for lots of discussions this year about a lot of things, things that were passed last couple of years. We want to make sure that we give a lot of recognition and kind of appreciation, honestly, to the work involved to try to put together the planning and the fiscal correctness of getting plans out like ESST and specifically to me, paid family medical leave. This is a big deal. And we want to make sure that we get to know the teams that kind of were putting together our work the last couple of years. And I've asked the Legislative Budget Office to come and testify. So if Director Larson could come forward, we'll get started with him and anybody else on his team. And then we'll have the agency come and kind of give their overview of sort of the fiscal notes, the process. I was working a lot on this last couple of years in this committee. And would like to kind of get some things better understood so that as we move forward, we kind of know what to expect this year. You know, when it comes to who can ask for a fiscal note and how appropriate are those, and just I learned a lot last couple of years. So, members, this is about just learning about this process. I think it's important to know each role that each one of these departments do for us as members, because we have to make the decision at the end of the day if this thing is it, does it seem accurate, reasonable, and all the words that these folks use every single day to do what they do. So welcome Director Larson to the committee. We appreciate you being here this morning, and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Representative Baker, members. I don't see the presentation being projected up on the screens. Do we want to wait for that, or do you want to move forward? There is copies of the slides in your packets, but also I'm not sure if we want them presented
before. We'd like to have them up on the board. Thank you. We'll get that up. Yep.
Everyone, can you hear me okay?
Yes, very good.
For the record, my name is Christian Larson, Director of the Legislative Budget Office. I was asked to come before you today to provide a background of the Legislative Budget Office and discuss the fiscal process. Today, we will really walk through three things: the role of the Legislative Budget Office, just who we are and what we do, what a fiscal note is and how the fiscal process works, and finally, we'll briefly describe a couple other fiscal estimates that are related to but not that are separate from the fiscal process, just to understand where all the different fiscal information comes from as it relates to the legislative process. The Legislative Budget Office is a nonpartisan legislative office serving both the House and the Senate. So we're a joint office. We have three statutory responsibilities. First, we coordinate and oversee the fiscal note process. And the fiscal note really answers the question, what is the fiscal effect of a proposed piece of legislation to the state government? We also run the local impact note process. That answers the question, what's the fiscal effect of a proposed piece of legislation to local units of government, so cities, townships, counties, and school districts? And we provide the professional and technical support to the Tax Expenditure Review Commission. That's a bicameral bipartisan commission that reviews tax expenditures and evaluates their effectiveness and the fiscal impact. And we provide the research analysis to support their work in evaluating those tax expenditures and provide the administrative support to that commission. So those are the three things the Legislative Budget Office does. The majority of this presentation will really now focus on the fiscal note process. I'm happy to talk about any of those other things. In fact, if you have any questions throughout the presentation, please feel free to stop me. And I can respond to questions as they come up. So the first thing we're going to talk about in the fiscal process is what governs fiscal notes. And there's a couple different statutes and a couple different documents that help govern the fiscal process. And the first is Minnesota Statute 3.98. That's the enacting legislation for fiscal notes. It describes, and we'll go through these in detail, what kind of requirements and kind of expectations of fiscal are in a minute, but just kind of describe what you can find in the governance, and then we'll talk about what that governance actually says in a moment. So 3.98 describes who can request a fiscal note. It broadly provides some requirements for the contents of a fiscal note and the requirements for distributions of completed fiscal notes, who needs to receive those once they're completed. Minnesota Statute 13.64 describes what an unofficial fiscal note is and describes that unofficial fiscal notes can be made classified, and we'll talk more in a minute what that means. It describes who can request unofficial fiscal notes and any requirements for keeping that information confidential, the responsibility to the different parties involved in the fiscal note process. And again, we'll talk about that in a second. And then Minnesota Statute 3.853 is the establishing statute for the Legislative Budget Office. That sets the standards for the requirements for standards and procedures to be adopted regarding the fiscal process. The standards and procedures are a more detailed document related to fiscal notes. It tells you what standards that there are, substantially more in more detail than Minnesota Statute 3.98, and it gives some procedures for how that should be carried out. And that document is, per statute, required to be approved by the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission. The Oversight Commission is the bicameral bipartisan commission that oversees the work of the Legislative Budget Office, four members from the House, four members from the Senate, and they review our work and approve the uniform standards and procedures. So what is a fiscal note? What's the standard say that a fiscal note is, and what does it have to have in it? It's an objective estimate of the fiscal impact of proposed legislation to the state budget. Again, what's the impact to the state budget is really the question we're asking. It needs to include estimates in the effect in in dollars. So on the front page of fiscal note, the cover page, you'll see a table with 5 years shown, the current fiscal year and the next four fiscal years. And that will be provided an estimate in dollars for what the fiscal effect of the bill is. That's kind of the headline of a fiscal note. You'll also see an estimate of the impact on full-time equivalent employees. So how much time does it take to accomplish whatever the bill is, or how much reduction in time is required from a bill, and then we're going to turn that into a full-time equivalent employee. That number will be included on the front of the fiscal note. So there's two headline numbers on the front of the fiscal note. Again, what's the increase or decrease in cost or revenues? And I should be clear, these are non-tax revenues. We'll talk about where tax revenue comes into play and where that information comes from at the end of this discussion, at the end of this presentation. But a fiscal note's really the impact on cost, up or down, and any non-tax revenue. So once you get through that front page of the cost and FTE or full-time equivalent employees, then you're going to have a narrative section, and it's a relatively robust narrative. The first thing provided is a description of the bill. Then you'll find the assumptions used to develop the estimate. So why does the fiscal note say what it says? And they should include any sources that they're citing, the agencies or the state entities responding are citing to say this is where we get the information to develop these estimates. Any formulas used or kind of detailed tables will then be included in this narrative section. There'll be discussion of the long-term fiscal effects. So if we look at that front page of a fiscal note, again, you see those five fiscal years. Anything that's not on those tables, included in those tables, should be discussed in the long-term fiscal implications. And finally, there is a discussion of the impact of local units of government. This is generally a narrative. There's rarely a really detailed estimate in this piece of a fiscal note. And so we'll talk about a local impact note, again, at the end of our discussion. That provides much more detailed analysis of local impact. But in the fiscal note, there is a section that speaks to local impact, and usually that's a high-level kind of general discussion of how that will likely impact local units of government. So that's what's included in a fiscal note. What are the standards, or what are the expectations of the fiscal note? Now, certainly there's a fairly detailed document, the Uniform Standards and Procedures, that provide estimate or that describes what has to be in a fiscal note. But generally, these are the things that we're looking for. First, it's the estimate from the current law base. And when we think about the current law base, we're really thinking about two things. What was the enacted budget at the end of the last legislative session? Or what was included in the most recent budget and economic forecast? Those are the two areas that we're starting point. So that's our starting point. So if a program is brand new, the starting point is zero. But if the program exists and we're making adjustments to that program, then that starting point is whatever was that enacting budget at the end of the previous legislative session, or what was included in the most recent budget and economic forecast. In a fiscal note, we need to make sure that assumptions are reasonable, accurate, and objective, and that assumptions and methodology provided include enough detail so that the reader can understand why a note really makes the estimate that it does. A fiscal note should be a standalone document that you don't need additional explanation to understand, that the reader should be able to read the document and say, okay, I understand why this impact, this fiscal effect, occurs as a result of this bill language. The general process for fiscal notes, is, as we kind of look at it, it's really kind of a five-step process. And the first is a fiscal request is submitted to the Legislative Budget Office. And we'll talk in a moment about the different types of fiscal notes and who can request those. But in general, a member makes a request for a fiscal note. That in practice goes through the fiscal analyst, so in this case, Ashley, will go into the system and make a request for a fiscal note in what we call the fiscal note tracking system, which is the IT system we use to facilitate the fiscal note process. That comes to the Legislative Budget Office. We read that language. We determine what agencies and what state entities are impacted by that language. We then assign that to the various state entities. They then receive that. And then this next step is where the majority of the work takes place in the fiscal note, and that is the developing of assumptions and estimates. And so the agencies and the state entities responding will put together those estimates. They'll submit them to us for review, and then we make sure that those estimates and those assumptions meet those standards that are approved by the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission in those fiscal note uniform standards and procedures. Most of the time, we'll have a back and forth with the agency. Can you clarify this? Can you define where this data came from? We did some research and found this in another state. It looks like this in terms of cost. Can you tell us why that is or is not the case? And so once we get to a point that we believe it meets standards, we approve the fiscal note. When the Legislative Budget Office approves the fiscal note, it then gets released to the legislature. And in most cases, we'll talk about the exceptions. It's a public document, so it will be immediately sent out to the bill author, the chair of the committee for which the bill stands, and a kind of a distribution list, or the commissioner of MMB, and then a distribution list that's signed up for maybe a particular committee. But then within 24 hours, it will be posted publicly on our website so anyone can find and search those public fiscal notes. So that's the general process. And then we have, I think it's important to understand that the different types of fiscal notes exist. And there's three different types of fiscal notes. The first is a regular fiscal note. And this is a fiscal note on introduced legislation. I'm sorry, let me catch up with my notes here. So it's an introduced legislation. So that's either an introduced bill, an engrossed bill, an amendment, just anything that can be acted upon by the legislature. So that's a regular fiscal note. Regular fiscal notes are made on behalf of the chair of the standing committee for which the bill resides, the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, and the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. So those are the folks that can officially request a regular fiscal note. Upon completion, they're publicly released and posted on the LBO website. And that's kind of what a regular fiscal note is. It's really kind of what most of us think of as a fiscal note. Unofficial fiscal notes are fiscal notes on draft legislation or legislation that has not yet been introduced. Any member can request an unofficial fiscal note, and upon completion, unless stated as classified, these are also released publicly. So that's also public information. If you request an unofficial fiscal note, everything is the same as a regular fiscal note, the only difference being it's on draft legislation. And then there's classified unofficial fiscal notes. And this is also on draft legislation, and it cannot have yet been considered publicly by a committee. So can't be introduced, and also can't even be say, hey, I have this bill. I'd like you to look at it. I haven't introduced it yet, but it's something to consider. As soon as it meets that standard, it's no longer eligible for being a classified unofficial fiscal note. So if this is on draft legislation that has not yet been considered, you can ask the requester to say, I want this to be, on this, again, the fiscal analyst say, we make sure this is a classified request. They'll submit as a classified request when they submit into the system. And that information needs to be treated as classified, non-public data. And that being both the bill language that was submitted and the fiscal note that was completed related to that fiscal note. And so the only people associated with the process that can see the information are the fiscal analyst who made the request on behalf of the member, the Legislative Budget Office, and the agencies assigned to that note. And so no one else can see that information. And it's the responsibility of those parties to make sure that information is maintained to be confidential. When it's released, it goes just to the fiscal analyst, who then will provide it to the member. And that's as far as that goes. If that bill then does get considered publicly by a committee or is introduced, then that fiscal then becomes public. And so if asked, then we will provide that information. So those are the types of fiscal notes. Just briefly, if we think about fiscal note activity in a kind of a given year, this chart you'll see here, we have teal bars on the left and gold bars on the right. The teal bars are the completed fiscal notes in a each year from 2015 to 2024, so over the last 10 years. And the gold bars are the agency assignments that make up that teal bar. So each fiscal note has a certain number of agencies assigned to it. If a bill impacts one agency, that fiscal note will have one agency assignment. If that bill impacts four agencies, that fiscal note will have four agency assignments. And as a general rule, it ends up being about a 2-to-1 ratio of agency assignments to fiscal notes requests. And so in a given year, on an operating budget year, and you really see kind of activity in two different years. So in operating budget years or odd number years, agencies complete about 800 fiscal notes in a given year. In terms of requests, that's about 1,000 plus requests, and then fiscal notes completed, in general, about 70% of fiscal note requested turn into a completed fiscal note, and they're not completed for a number of reasons. Oftentimes they get activated because language gets amended, things of that nature. So in a given operating budget year, about 800 fiscal notes get completed, and on average about 1,500 fiscal note agency assignments get completed. And to kind of speak to the workload of the office, and especially to agencies in this case, that there is a lack of, like when you're looking at this table, there's additional work that takes place for fiscal notes that aren't all the way to completion that isn't accounted for in this graph. So just to acknowledge the work that agencies do that isn't accounted for in this graph, in the sense that a note might get inactivated, one agency completed that portion of the note, just to make that clear. In non-operating budget years, the average completed fiscal notes is about 550, with average agency assignments completed over 1,000. And so, again, this is, again, just to give a sense of the workload of the fiscal note process. One thing we think is useful is to think about how the legislature can positively support the functionality of the fiscal note process. And the first thing to understand is that the volume of requests does impact agency responsiveness at some level. That every session, it kind of ramps up. There's a big curve early, and by the second deadline, things kind of fall off in terms of fiscal note requests. But there's about a 10-week period where requests outpace the agency's ability to complete fiscal notes in a given week. And so you're going to see more requests come in that can go out in a single week for a lot of agencies. It's just the nature of the legislative process. So it's important to understand that volume does impact capacity of agencies in terms of fiscal responsiveness. In those cases, then, communication is key. There's not a formal prioritization process for fiscal notes. There's not like a set, like, this means this one has to be done first, then this one. But there is informal prioritization that has to take place, again, because at times capacity is outpaced by demand. So in those cases, we work with committee staff to make sure we know what's going to be heard, when it's going to be heard, so we can say, okay, these five fiscal notes need to be done this week. This one's going to be heard on Tuesday. Can you get that one done first? Things of that nature. And so the communication from the committee is really useful. We also like to suggest to members that as you're developing bills or you want to have a discussion about the bill with the Legislative Budget Office, we find that useful. It's useful for us to understand the author's intent of a fiscal note or of a bill so that when agencies respond, we can see if that aligns. Now, to be clear, when a fiscal note is completed, it's going to be how the agency will implement that bill. And it may be that the fiscal assumptions don't align with how the author intends the fiscal note to see, to kind of show what they think should happen. But if we can identify that early in the process, we can save time and communicate to the author and say, hey, the agency's responding in this way. We think that's a reasonable response, given this is how what the language says, so that conversation can happen even before the fiscal note gets completed. And so having those communications with the Legislative Budget Office is useful early in the process. Last thing I would mention is that precise bill language supports a quicker response on fiscal notes. The more the precise the language is, the easier it is to say, like, this is exactly what the assumptions should look like, and therefore we can move that forward a little quicker. There's less questions, less concern. Agencies can get to the point of developing those assumptions quicker as opposed to saying, what's the different ways that this could be implemented? So that really kind of wraps the conversation on fiscal notes. Just I want to briefly touch on a couple other fiscal estimates that are supporting the legislative process. The first of those is the local impact note. And again, this is the estimate of the fiscal effects to local units of government. And local units of government in this case means cities, townships, counties, and school districts. And those are produced by the Legislative Budget Office. Where we oversee the fiscal note process, we're reviewing assumptions, we're reviewing the estimates provided by state entities. In the local impact note process, the Legislative Budget Office is collecting information from local units of government and then developing a report based on that information. Kind of to contrast the fiscal note to local impact note, local impact notes take a substantially longer amount of time to complete, and it's like between 2 and 6 months. Fiscal note on average gets completed in 2 weeks. Now, that's different depending on the complexity of the bill. Some take much longer, some take less time. But on average, a fiscal note gets completed in about 13, 14 days, calendar days. There also are substantially fewer requests. So again, we talked about in a regular operating budget year, we have about 1,000 plus requests for a fiscal note, which turned to about 800-ish completions. For local impact notes, we have between 0 and 5 in any given year. So just a substantially fewer amount of local impact notes. And I think it's also important to understand that the output you get there's a literature review included, there's analysis of any public data that's available, and then there's oftentimes a survey to local units of government, so it's a pretty substantial document. It's very kind of reporty in terms of what it looks like, the output, a little bit different than a fiscal note. And so for those reasons, that's why it takes kind of that longer amount of time. It requires a different level of resources. So that's a local impact note. And again, the process for requesting those, technically a local impact note is made on, can be requested by the chair and minority lead of the Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee and then the tax committees and the respective bodies. So those are the four members that can make requests for local impact notes. And then in practice, again, the members go and talk to those folks that may want a request, and they'll work with the local fiscal analyst, and then we'll move forward with those requests as they come in. The last thing I wanted to mention, revenue analyses or revenue estimates. These are produced by the Department of Revenue, and this is where that tax impact comes in. And so a revenue estimate is estimating the impact of legislation on state tax revenues and tax expenditures and on property tax aids and credits. So that's where we're getting that tax impact. Oftentimes these are produced when a bill reaches the tax committee, and so not on the same timeline necessarily as the fiscal note. The fiscal note request comes in and gets completed at any time during the process. Oftentimes the revenue estimate is going to come in at that tax committee. And so if you have a bill that has a fiscal effect and a tax impact, you won't see that full picture until maybe it gets to that tax committee. So it's just important to understand how those two documents interact. And that's kind of where then that full picture is understood at that point. From there, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Director Larson. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a few things. I'm actually going to start with two compliments, Mr. Chair. Number one is I really appreciate, and I think it's noteworthy, that we're starting off with these two educational hearings. I feel like in some other committees, the very first hearing has been kind of diving in. And I know tomorrow, obviously, we're going to hear a bill. We'll go back and forth on that. But I'm really glad we've started both yesterday and today with kind of setting the stage. So thank you for that. The other compliment is, and I don't know that this came out in the presentation so much, but folks who are newer, the Legislative Budget Office is relatively new. I think it was either our first term, Mr. Chair, maybe our second term, proposed by the GOP majority then. And I recall, I wasn't real involved, but I remember that on our DFL side, we really, before then, it was the Minnesota Management of Budget that ran the fiscal note process entirely. And we resisted that quite a bit, that idea. And I think that time has proven that that was actually wrong. And so let's all remember that you can actually be wrong in the course of the legislative process. I think that we've learned that LBO has turned out to be a nice innovation. So compliments to you. Into your team and pushing that. I want to go back to the slide, if we can, about fiscal note governance. I had a meeting relatively recently with the LBO, and because there's another component of this that kind of didn't come out in the conversation. And one is sort of who can request a fiscal note, and maybe just because that does feel like a pretty important point. So we can just, if we have the testifier, just describe who can request fiscal notes. That seems like an important thing for newer members of the committee to know, Mr. Chair. And then I'll have a couple questions following up on that.
Thank you, Rick. Representative Pinto, Director Larson.
Baker, Representative Pinto. Yeah, thank you for the question. I apologize. I probably skipped over that part in my notes. And so a very important question is who can request a fiscal note. So for a regular fiscal note, again, a fiscal note on an introduced piece of legislation or a piece of legislation that could be acted upon by the legislature, the people who can make a request is the chair of the committee for which the bill resides, the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, and the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. So those are the members that can make requests for regular fiscal notes. For unofficial fiscal notes and unofficial classified fiscal notes, for fiscal notes on not introduced pieces of legislation, any member can make a request on those fiscal notes.
Okay.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then thank you for that. And then and this is going to get a little wonky, but if we you'll be shocked that I'm going to get wonky, same for Representative Schultz. So if you look at the first line, fiscal notes, Minnesota Statute 3.98, so that is the statute that says this is what a fiscal note is, and the people who can request them are Chair Baker and his fellow chairs, Chair Torkelson, and then Chair Marty and the Senate chairs. The next line, 13.64, is in the Data Practices Act, and I won't have Mr. Larson confirm all this. That describes if there is another unofficial fiscal note that's made by somebody, that talks about how confidential or classified are the circumstances. Maybe just I'll pause there because then I want to push on something. But if we can have Mr. Larson just confirm, I've kind of described that accurately. Anything else he wants to add on that, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Larson.
Chair Baker and Representative Pinto, that's correct.
Okay.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative.
All right. You're always a chair. Once a chair, always a chair.
There you go. That's about right. I know that's Chair David's attitude, Mr. Chair. Yep. Fair enough. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Larson, so the thing that, and you and I had a conversation about this, that 13.64, it's defining an unofficial fiscal note for purposes of the Data Practices Act. It's if we won't bring it up, but I'm, so, of course, if I, as a member of the minority, I'm a member of the legislature, I want an agency to respond to me about anything, I would hope that they would respond to me. And if I'm asking for something that is the cost of a draft legislation I have, that language describes whether it's classified. Does that 13.64 sort of give my request to the agency sort of any particular extra status as compared with 3.98 when Chair Baker is making a request or Chair Torkelson is making a request? I'm just trying to understand the distinction between a fiscal note and an unofficial fiscal note, if you can sort of enlighten on that.
Director Larson.
Baker and Chair, Representative Pinto. Yeah, so the 3.98 is definitely more clear that says here's the responsibility of agencies in responding to a fiscal note. 13.64 does not speak to that in the same way. In practice, how we, to your point earlier, that we inherited the process from MMB. What we understood is practice before we existed, and how we've moved forward is that all active fiscal requests, whether official or unofficial, or I'm sorry, regular or unofficial, should be responded to. That again, prioritization does take place, and so that happens. It's just the reality of the legislative process. But we've always understood that all fiscal requests should be responded to. But to your point, it's not clear. In statute, in 13.64 does not have this clear statement of a requirement to respond in the same way that perhaps 3.98 does.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe I'll close just to say the way I think it's at least ambiguous if we look at 13.64. Again, if any member of the legislature requests something of an agency, they certainly should be responding. And yet, as we saw in this presentation, there are limited resources. And I think, Mr. Chair, I think you and I may be the only people on Ways and Means. I think it probably would make sense for us to talk with Chair Torkelson and Lead Stevenson to sort of clean that up. You could imagine a situation where, you know, agencies get overwhelmed with requests from individual members. And ultimately, the only real statutory fiscal notes are the ones that are requested by the chairs. I think just if you look at it, it's those are very different statutes, and it seems like it's what 13.64 is more about is just what are the circumstances where I can make a request and have it be kept confidential. So I think we just want to recognize for all of us the fiscal notes that get made, and I say this as a member of the minority, are the ones that you request, Mr. Chair, and the other chairs. And then we can make requests to agencies, they certainly should be responding to us, but it's certainly not in the same league or the same spot because there's just limited resources. At least that's how I read the statute, and again, I think it probably makes sense in ways for them to take a look at if we really do want unofficial fiscal notes to have an actual sort of status, we probably want to make that clear in the statute. Anyway, thank you, Chair.
And I appreciate that comment, Lead Pinto. I think that's kind of the reason for today, too. And I appreciate you recognizing the need for this. I want to set we're trying to set the table here of who should be able to get a fiscal note request. Any member sitting here should get one. If you request one, even on draft legislation, but there are priorities. And like you said, Representative Pinto, that needs to happen. I didn't know that in my tenure. I've never been a chair until now. And you've had a chance to experience that for a number of sessions. And so I'm going to lean towards you to say what makes sense, what doesn't. If anybody here on either side wants a fiscal note, you should be able to request that. If you need to go through the chair just from a – I will help you. I think this is – why wouldn't we? Now, again, last session – was incredibly heavy on the fiscal note requests. We were going through a workforce committee last year last 2 years, and we were waiting and waiting and waiting for obvious reasons, especially when it came to paid family. It was incredibly complex, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when maybe kind of what were the challenges that Deed was really facing. They're real, but I appreciate that because I didn't know that, and 10 years later, I'm now realizing that we are entitled to that information. I have an idea. Here's a bill. If it's going to cost too much, then I don't want to touch it. That's what we do. And so I appreciate that, making sure that's more clear. Could it be clearer? Sure. I wish I'd have known. I would have maybe had to ask Chair Zhang at the time, hey, I need this. Can you help me some? I don't think it happened. But I kept asking the testifiers, and it wasn't happening. So anyway, thank you for that. I appreciate that. Any other members before we move on? Because I wouldn't bring up our department up here. I know, Director Liz Larson, you'll probably be calling up again here. So if you want to either move over, but I want to call up our friends at Deed to have them come up and kind of go through this process as well and why this is a little different and what you guys look at the department too. So thank you. Also, members, while Mr. Rowe gets set up, in your packet today there was a extra piece of paper with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. That one actually is set up for tomorrow. Okay, so I apologize, a little extra paper, but we'll have it again in tomorrow's packet as well. So I just wanted a little housekeeping issue there. Good morning, Mr. Rowe. Welcome to the committee. It's great to have you here in front of us. You know this story. Introduce yourself and please proceed with our discussion this morning.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. My name is Evan Rowe, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I did not pull together a presentation, but I just figured, because I figured my sense was, what would be most helpful is kind of just a conversation, yeah. Maybe a general discussion about approaches. I think Director Larson provided an excellent kind of overview of the fiscal note process. I can maybe offer a few comments on just, kind of the agency perspective and fiscal notes overall, and then maybe just, and then I imagine we might want to talk a little bit more about the paid leave law and kind of, and some things that are a bit unique about that. And then very happy to answer questions from the committee. Obviously, as Director Ellison mentioned, agencies receive many fiscal note requests throughout the course of the session. That the information that is collected by the LBO is critical to providing policy, legislators and policymakers with fiscal information. We take that responsibility very seriously. It is, it's absolutely critical for the for the overall function of government. Generally speaking, each bill is different. Each piece of legislation is different. The analyses that are required are different, and state staff will work hard to develop the analyses that are required to successfully complete the fiscal note with the checks and balances that are provided by the Legislative Budget Office in terms of approving. I think maybe a couple things that just make the paid leave law a little bit different in the sense is, I think, as you noted, Mr. Chair, there is, just greater complexity given the size and scale of that program. It is a social, it's a social insurance program that it is at a significant scale. We very much want to make sure that we are providing accurate information and very clear data. The other piece is that under the law, the department is required to conduct actuarial analyses for the modeling, for the modeling of kind of overall programmatic benefits and expenditures. We contract with a third-party actuarial analysis, which again is required under the law. And that comes with, a couple points. It comes with a bit of lead time because we have to kind of coordinate with this third-party entity. We need to collect the relevant data. There, the third-party actuaries have, kind of very detailed modeling that they have built out. And, we want to deliver that as soon as we can, but there is sort of lead time that is not always within our control. We also have to collect the data that kind of underpins some of that analysis, our labor market information team and the like do that. Not all bills require not all things, for the purposes of the paid leave law would require an actuarial analysis. There are some things that we can and will do internally as an agency and work with the LBO on that front. The other thing I would just note about actuarial analyses is that they are not free. There is a cost, there is a financial cost to the agency in completing those. So, as in terms of trying to be good stewards of taxpayer resources and, you know, provide timely work products to the legislature. We want to work in partnership, with you, Chair Baker, with LEADS, to make sure that we're kind of, to the extent that we can consolidate requests, that kind of helps hold the cost down. Hopefully will help improve kind of speed around those. I do think that, given that we do have actuarial analyses already, I'm optimistic that we'll be able to turn things, faster than in previous years. And still, there are kind of third-party elements that we just want to make sure that we're managing, both in terms of time expectations and costs. So maybe that would be where I'd conclude my preliminary remarks, but naturally, happy, of course, any questions from members would be welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. I think what I want to make sure that you help our new committee here, and again, many of us were on the Labor Committee, some on Workforce. We heard parts of this last year. I know that the Workforce Committee is where the bill originated from paid families. So, and I do want to focus on that pathway that I sort of experienced the last couple of years. I know even for members here, former Representative Richardson was the initial author of the paid family medical leave, and then Representative Frazier picked it up and sort of carried it on and did a great job kind of explaining the process as well. That was, I think, at the end of 23, and you did that in 24. So this bill has had a lot of, changes to it. One of the things I'd like to have you comment as well is give us the history, Mr. Rowe, on the different modeling plans that happened since 2023 early and then where we're at today and that process of the big change.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for the 2023 session, the department used a micro-simulation model that was provided by originally the Institute for Women's Policy Research and then updated by the United States Department of Labor. So that was the approach that we used, I think you'd call it a multivariate regression model, which our staff was able to use and kind of update, used for the 2023 session. And that was the basis for the fiscal notes that we had issued during the 2023 session. The paid leave law required the department to, by October 31st of 2023, then contract with a qualified independent actuarial consultant to then do, to essentially remodel the program with that actuary, which we then did and issued the report. I think the sense from members has been, the desire was that that the actuarial analysis was preferred by members of committees and by legislators. So subsequent analyses we have employed, the actuarial consultants to update those models going forward. And indeed, in 2024, the paid leave law was updated. Originally, the way that premiums are calculated was via the 23 law. Had a formula in going forward. The department is required to consult with the qualified actuary annually for the purposes of setting premiums. So I think the preference of kind of using that actuarial analysis, which it was kind of stated by the legislature and enacted into law. Is that responsive to your question?
Mr. Rowe, it is. I think, again, and just so folks are clear that I've been here for 10 years. We don't use actuarial studies that often. I think normally departments and agencies can kind of handle these fiscal notes on themselves and their own. Again, we've gotten the Milliman reports. If you haven't seen it, they're certainly public and online. But that was a major shift in kind of going from one model to another. And I think using the actuarial study is the right way to move forward. Again, history, what I recall is the goal on the front end was a 0.7 kind of a model of a payroll tax, a benefit insurance premium, whatever we want to call this. That was the initial, I guess, idea that it was going to be at. And actuarial came in at a 0.88. So that was deeper study, maybe better analysis, totally over my head and my pay grade to understand how that all goes into that. But to make a major change like that to a modeling system, halfway through that biennium is a big deal. I just want to make sure that the department or our committee knows that. To that point, again, we also now have the local impact studies as well that have been kind of released too. So we now know, again, as Director Larson had said, the local impact study takes 2 to 6 months to really get out. And that really helps identify what is this going to do to our local counties and our school boards and things like that. earlier this year, before we officially got started, we heard some testimony, and we'll hear that again. But I just, it's making a bigger impact on this. As people are getting up to speed on what this is really going to look like as we all move forward, it's becoming more clear as all these things move forward. And I just want to make sure that we continue to kind of work on those kinds of things. So getting around to, I suppose, my concern, my frustration has been very open with Mr. Rowe about when I was requesting some fiscal notes. And I just want to say this, that, you know, 2 years ago, a year ago, I don't remember now, but back in, I think it was February of 24, I had requested a fiscal note to understand what would it look like if we excluded 20 and under employees. If a small company said, I can't do this, what would that look like? Because I wanted to know, is it 20, is it 10, is it 5? I didn't know. I was kind of spitballing a bit. I think I put in a couple of requests, and I never got an answer. I never really got ever a fiscal note returned to me with an understanding. I kept asking about it. I kept asking fiscal folks. I kept asking and asking, and I wasn't getting anywhere. Can you help me understand sort of what happened with my fiscal note, my request? Again, I was the lead of the committee. I did not go through the chair. So help me just, so others will learn from what happened in maybe my experience, Mr. Rowe.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think some of it, what it kind of goes back to is the, I think, discussion you were having with Lead Pinto sort of on some of the issues around unofficial fiscal notes versus official fiscal notes. I believe the request that you had made was an unofficial fiscal note, if I'm not mistaken. And I think given some of the conversations around, just resourcing and time and things like that. The department was responding to a variety of kind of programmatic changes in the last session, as part of the official fiscal note processes for the bills that were going to be heard in this committee and the like. With that being said, I think there are probably places where we could have more clearly communicated that, that element and sort of that piece. And certainly we want to make sure that we're in close contact and close communication with all members of the committee and trying to get you the work product that you need. But again, I think one thing that we have to be kind of careful of is just using the taxpayer resources that it does cost for, again, actuarial studies and the like, using those for legislation that is going to be, that is likely to be heard and, possibly going to become law. So I think it's sort of a resource balancing question, and I think we can always do better in terms of communicating and making those points clear, and you certainly have our commitment that will continue in the future.
Yeah, and thank you, I guess, and I'm a chair now, so that should make a difference.
That does make a difference,
and
Mr. Chair.
President Pinto knows that too, right? And again, I'm newbie. I'm new at this game, but I want to make sure we understand this better. Mm-hmm. But again, I put that back in February of 24. You had a couple of other updates with the actuarial company that you hired, Milliman, mm-hmm. since that time, and even back in 2024. So I think your comment about your resources and the timing of it was complex. I don't find a very good answer to that from February to the end of session. I still got nothing. And yet you still had other actuarial letters that were put out because the numbers were changing. The more clarity was coming out. And so, again, I cannot accept that for any member going forward that they just sort of get put on the back burner because you're busy. And, again, I get it. Session, you will find your members. It is chaotic, and yet I really appreciate everybody that looks at numbers and dives through this. We have to get this right, and so what I didn't do was give you 10 different bills with 10 different ideas. I gave you one, and I think that's what the message today is, members, is if you're going to do this, especially in the paid family stuff, the department does have to probably pay somebody to get you an answer versus doing it themselves in-house. So I ask everybody to be respectful of that. I don't want to waste any money. But we owe it to the taxpayers to get it right, and we owe it to the folks that are going to start paying this tax, this payroll tax for this socialized insurance program. So we have to make sure that we take the time to get this right, because that's one of my frustrations, is that I don't think that was done in a way that now I can really analyze what other ideas I might have for the bill as the chair. So I want to make sure that is identified as well. So the two actuarial studies that were done last year, maybe you can explain a little bit to the committee what sort of things happened to help change that, or why did you request that? And are you in, just give us an update as to your current status with the company that you hire with current fiscal note requests, and what's kind of actively happening now, if you could. So from the kind of a major change we had from the seven-day window, and you can talk about that, but just help us, again, understand why there was a couple of notes requested last year that cost the state money from the actuarial study, the initial one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so I would say that analyses that were done last year were, again, I think responsive to proposed legislation that was either requested as a fiscal note or was expected to be introduced. So it was for the purpose of being able to provide that analysis in a timely manner. I would say we actually just had a very good conversation with the actuaries yesterday, given that we expect a variety of fiscal note requests. And essentially what we're kind of working on right now is sort of getting the baseline assumptions in place so that, we're updating some of the underlying economic data so that, we're ready to rock and roll. And then I think what I would say is, in close partnership with you and House fiscal staff and the LBO, I think we'll be in a position where, based on fiscal notes that, fiscal note requests that do come in, we'll be in a good position to, respond to those requests in partnership with the actuaries. So I think we've been working on, they are currently under contract with us. We have capacity, not infinite capacity, of course. We want to be thoughtful with those resources, and I appreciate reinforcing that message to the committee. And I think, we're trying to get the pieces in place so that, given the crunch of the legislative session, we're ready to go.
So one of the questions I just asked, too, was help us understand this change that happened. So I'll try to explain it, and you correct me if I'm wrong. But also in 2024, members, there was some testimony that was pretty remarkable, and some folks had assumed that when they took a family leave that they were going to get paid the day they left. The seven-day window was what was in question. So the actuarial study that was first done assumed the legislature's intent was that these families would take seven, we'll just use a bonding leave request. They would take, I'd say, 12 weeks off. The assumption of the actuarial was you won't get paid for the first 7 days because you're going to leave. It kicks in after the seventh day. You start getting paid on the eighth day. You're out, and then you get your payments. Well, that was not what was later found out by some groups, that that's not what we thought this was, and the groups talked to Representative Frazier about this, and you correct me if I'm wrong too, Representative, about that was a change. That was a pretty major change into the fiscal cost of this is an extra 7 days right up front. So again, that was a pretty big shift. I think Mr. Rowe had to pick up the phone, call the middleman. Whoop, we got an issue here. They didn't understand the intent of that bill, the intent of what the language was. Or maybe it was a change and we clarified the change with some better legislation. That changed a lot of that, too. So that was, again, coming out in through the session last year, again, March, April. I think that was received by your office probably in the early part of May, something like that. The new numbers came out at the very end of session. I think May 15th it came out. The final kind of the re-upped number with the seven-day change. I mean, this is 6 days before we adjourn from session, members. And so for me, a guy kind of yelling from the sidelines, trying to say, how do we know what this is going to cost, was a big deal to me and to all the families and to the folks that have to pay this. This is what it is today, and we really don't have any time to do much with it at this point. I want to make sure that is kind of out there to know why I think this fiscal discussion needs so much understanding. I have never been part of a socialized insurance program before. This is a big deal for anybody. I don't think there's ever been a bigger mandate, if you will, a mandated program to come through the state of Minnesota under the Department of Economic Development, as maybe as large as this one. It does mirror the MNLARS and the MNsure and those big IT systems and those big launches. So this is going to take us to get this right because this has not been launched yet. So I just want to, I want to give history and I want to learn from it, Mr. Rowe. And I think that's the point that I'm trying to make here today is we cannot make these mistakes. Mr. Rowe, are there currently any requests for actuarial changes today from the current bill that you're working from? I know you had a lot of meetings around the state over the summer, listening sessions. I think I asked you this question earlier. Are there any changes or plans or recommendations to the members that we need to tweak anything of what you may have heard out there? Because right now, we can still tweak this thing. We can still change it. We can do a lot of different things, and you'll see some ideas this year. But after all of what you heard, is there any other tweaks to this that you are recommending? And maybe you've got the actuarial working on something to bring to us at a later point. Is that on the table at this point?
Mr. Chair, no, it is not.
Then there's no recommendations by the department that we have to make. We would suggest any tweaks to the system at this point.
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Representative Pinto, did you have a question? Sorry. Okay. Sorry. Representative Frazier, yes. Anytime.
Thank you. You've been largely accurate in kind of laying out how we got to where we are now. I just want to state, I mean, you mentioned that, are there any tweaks for the bill? It's currently in law. It's a statute. It's not a bill proposal. It's the law that's set to take effect January 1st. I don't want to scare people out there that are watching this and think that this is something different. I will point out that you mentioned you haven't been a part of a socialized insurance program, but our UI program is a very large program that DEED administers now. It's one of the best in the country. And yes. This setup has been based on that foundational program UI that we have. So I'm very confident that we're going to be okay. It's not. You mentioned Menlars, and I know people freak out about that. I just don't want people to think that this is not a Menlars situation. We have a program very large that is working very well. In fact, was critical in many Minnesotans ensuring that they had what they need during the pandemic. And so we are based on that program, and I think we're in a very good spot too. And we're ready to go for January 1st.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Frazier. But what's different about UI is that's a federal program that's backed by the feds, too, that if we fall short, that's what that is. Representative Frazier.
I'm glad you brought that up because yesterday we had talked about the impacts of what's happened at the federal level. That's one of the programs that was impacted greatly. I think DEED was shut out for about 5 hours from having access to that program, which put a lot of Minnesotans in a tough place in terms of resources that they needed to take care of themselves.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Baker. And Commissioner, I am new to this committee, but definitely not new to this issue, as I've heard from countless entities around my community about the trepidation of all this. So I have just as I'm getting myself into this committee, I have a question. First of all, how did you decide which entity to contract with to do actuarial studies, and how much do they normally cost the taxpayers? And Chair, if you would please, I will have a follow-up question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mueller. We did a competitive procurement for the for contracting with the with this actuarial firm. The firm, just for your awareness, is a firm called Milliman. They are kind of the nationally, a national actuarial analysis firm. They conduct work with private and public entities around the country, and the kind of particular team that we work with at Milliman, has expertise in paid leave programs nationwide. They've done kind of similar analyses for state programs and private programs around the country. In terms of the overall cost, that part of what we part of the reason we do the RFP is to kind of get the best price and have everybody kind of compete for the state's business on this front. From memory, I think the total kind of contract value that we had over the two-year period is about $119,000. So that's kind of covered sort of the initial actuarial analysis that we did, which involved quite a bit of model development and pieces like that. And it's given us, again, some contract room to be able to conduct supplemental analyses for things like fiscal notes like we were discussing today.
President Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Baker. The initial RFP value was $119,000 to do the initial model, and you said there was supplemental activity that had to be done or supplemental evaluations. Were those also added to the amount that we paid as taxpayers for this service?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just as a point of clarification, the total contract value, I believe, for the two-year period is about $119,000. So that is, I think, the first kind of the the actuarial analyses from actuarial analysis from October 2023 that was required by the paid leave statute. That was a requirement made of the department. Again, I think the total cost was about $69,000, and then on top of that, we've had kind of some allowance built in for supplemental analyses. So again, about $50,000 in additional contract value to be able to conduct supplemental analyses for the purposes of developing fiscal notes.
Follow-up, Representative Mueller? Okay, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So following up in this conversation, who is it that pays for a third-party actuarial study?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, the funding for the – it comes out of the funding that was allocated for implementation of the paid leave law, which was appropriated as part of Laws 2023.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whose money is that?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I think the money was appropriated out of the general fund and appropriated into the family and medical benefit insurance account.
And whose money is that?
Commissioner Rowe, slow down, Mr. There we go. Yep, there we go. Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, I mean, the general fund, I believe, is funded by the taxpayers of Minnesota, which is why, as a department, we try to take very, you know, we try to be very careful and thoughtful about the ways in which we are conducting the analyses.
Mm-hmm. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what duty does the agency have to deliver results that come from a third-party study for the legislature and who represents the people of Minnesota?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I guess, could you perhaps clarify your question in terms of what you mean by duty?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the study that was conducted in accordance with law from October of 2023, when was that report complete?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I believe the report was Chapter 59 of Laws 2023 required the department to deliver the actuarial study by October 31st, 2023. I believe that report was tendered to the Legislative Reference Library a few days before that, maybe October 28th. I don't remember the exact date, but it was on time.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is the actuarial analysis that was completed for the paid family medical leave law was available for the review of the public and for the members of the legislature in October of 23. Is that correct?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then when was the fiscal note delivered to the legislature with the results of the actuarial analysis?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, the October actuarial analysis was not tied to a specific fiscal note. It was a work product that was required by, again, Chapter 59 of Laws of 2023, sort of as I guess you might consider it a supplement to the fiscal note that was done in 2023 using the micro-simulation model that I previously referenced.
Representative Schultz?
No,
for now. All right. Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, I want to note that I do recall from the debates and conversation committee prior to this bill getting passed into legislation that I thought it was insightful and important that you wanted you mentioned actuary analysis multiple times.
Correct.
And I remember conversations with Representative Richardson around that, and ultimately that was put into the bill. And I think it was great foresight on your part and insight to put that in place. And I do want to thank you for bringing that, because I do think the actuarial study has actually been very helpful, and it's important because I think with the actuarial study we're put in place with it being requested. And I think the annual piece was put in. Came from the Senate side. I forget which senator it was, but that asked for that. I also thought that was important because we want to make sure that this program is sustainable, and these actuary studies do put us in a position to do that. And what I recall from last year, after the consternation we had, the intent was always to be for that 7 qualifying day period to actually be paid after you met the qualifying period. That's where most of the consternation came from. Middleman had actually done multiple runs in terms of counting, not counting the 7 days and counting the 7 days. When we figured that out, we did actually have those numbers, and those numbers were actually there prior to the committee hearing that we got to, where we were actually able to publicly display that document. So ultimately, things worked out in terms of the sense with that study being put in place and having the numbers that we needed to ensure that we are putting in place the premiums necessary to make sure the program is sustainable. So again, thank you, because that was insightful on your part to have that actuary study put in place.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Frazier. And I agree. I think this is the right way to model this thing out, is with that actuarial study. Pay somebody to do it. That's fine. I think that their focus is different, because they're not dealing with a thousand other bills to be looking at to try to work through. I want to go back, though, to just the basic, though, of in the 24 session, when we had the change in the seven-day model that was more clear then in the intent, because this actuarial study that was released was not what the intent of Representative Frazier was at that point. We learned that early in session, 2024. Was that February, March we learned of that, Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Chair, that sounds about right.
And to that, I mean, they're probably 2-3 weeks out from getting back to you when you request maybe any kind of an actuarial update. Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Chair, it does depend. I mean, it does depend somewhat on the level of complexity of the changes. But, you know, I think in that case, you know, that's not far off. You know, some things can be much more, some things that can be much more complicated than that.
So, Commissioner, then help me understand, why was it that we didn't see the number until the end of session? You sat on those numbers of what the new updated numbers were. You received this in sometime in March. Why did we not see it until the middle of May?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that the fiscal note was formally requested because Representative Frazier can correct my memory if I'm getting this wrong, but I don't think the bill was actually introduced till much later in the session. So the fiscal note is tied to the bill, and once the bill was introduced and the fiscal note requested, then that was kind of the thing that would tie the fiscal note.
But Commissioner, the bill was introduced in 2023. It was generally the same bill. There's a couple different changes to the fiscal understandings of this, but you got an updated actuarial letter from Milliman in the, you said, March-ish, and I'm just wondering why we didn't see that at the end of that period. And then I'll go right to you, Representative Frazier, if that's okay.
Mr. Chair, I think, again, our work product is tied to the fiscal note process, right? And we when a fiscal note is requested from the agency, we fulfill the fiscal note request. But I think there isn't inherently a lever that would have moved it in that direction. And again, I would say that our work is to kind of follow the fiscal note process.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will say, Deputy Commissioner is correct in terms of the timing. It did take a while before we decided to actually introduce the bill that had the technical fixes in there necessary to clarify the initial seven-day qualifying period. Some of it had to do with the pace of that legislative session last year. And initially, I was not on the bill as the author. And so part of that was me getting in and getting up to speed and then understanding that we needed to move forward to make some of these technical fixes. So some of that delay was part of the internal workings and conversations around that in regards to a fiscal note being put with that once we introduce the bill. But I will just reiterate again, the actuarial studies were very helpful because they were there and they were very helpful in making sure we made those clarifications that were necessary to get us to the end point to where we came up with the rate, the actual true rate that we needed to have to ensure the sustainability of the program.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. And my question is, if DEED feels it was appropriate that the result of those studies were released to the legislative body just 5 days before session ended in 2024.
Commissioner Rowe?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the agency's, first objective is to follow the law and the process for fiscal note requests. I do think one salutary benefit of this kind of conversation is understanding what the expectations of the committee are, and I think that's been very helpful, and I'm very hopeful that kind of going forward in this session we'll have the ability to produce those analyses earlier in the session.
Representative Zalesnikar?
Thank you, because it appears the impact from 0.7 to the 0.88 is substantially different to the employee and the employer.
Is that?
And so my question is, would it have been possible to get that data to the legislative body before 5 days before session ended for further discussion?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess, again, generally, I mean, I suppose it would be possible. I think the, you know, general, again, the general approach, though, is that we are responsive to fiscal note requests that come from the legislature. And, again, kind of following the fiscal note process as we did last year, I think, you know, that's what we sought to do.
Any follow-up, Representative? Okay. Maybe to that question, I'm going to go with Representative Mecklen next. Do we currently have a public number to what this payroll tax will be? I mean, we've talked about 0.88, we've heard 0.93, we've heard 0.78 before. Is there something published at this point, Commissioner Rowe, that businesses know and counties know and school districts will know? What will this cost look like starting in 2026? Is that number public?
Mr. Chair, I would say that the again, coming out of the 24th session, you know, the fiscal note kind of referenced a 0.88% premium rate, you know, suggested at launch. The department is, I think is working to kind of finalize and confirm that for public announcement as sort of the final value.
And I want to clarify to the public that we've been talking about 0.88. It's public, but it's not maybe published and official. I want to make sure that that's clear, because, you know, companies and, again, large employers like school districts and counties and so on, they need to know what this looks like so they can start planning in the future, too. When do you expect that to be actually made official?
We expect, Mr. Chair, we expect very soon.
Can you be more specific, Mr. Rowe? Like before session ends? This is important. Do you have any kind of a without putting a date, but yeah. 2 weeks, 4 weeks?
I don't have, Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific date at this time, but we are certainly working.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps Representative Frazier can help me remember this. I recall that yesterday, as those technical changes were coming into play, and there was some back and forth conversation in the Labor Committee, and I'm guessing in jobs as well. But that was concluded prior to 5 days before the end of session. I mean, it was probably 3-4 weeks when the final draft came out or what have you. But in that, where I'm confused now by listening to all this, how did you order studies for the language that wasn't created yet before the language was created? If the studies were done in, was it March and April, but the language didn't come out till after that because it was still kind of a fluid project or work in progress, who had the idea to order the studies before the final draft was figured out? Can somebody help me kind of wrap my brain around this?
Commissioner Rowe or Commissioner Frazier, I'll let you answer if you feel like that. What did I say, Commissioner?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry, Representative Frazier, or Commissioner Rowe. I guess you tell me. Yeah.
I was going to say I'm not sure I'm quite tracking the question. So,
Representative Frazier, do you want to take a stab?
Let me repeat. I think what you're asking is, if we did not have language for the technical changes, how could they go back and get an actuary study to reflect the language that we ultimately put in? Is that what you're asking?
Representative Mecklen.
Mr. Chair, yes, because it was just discussed here that the final language came out later, and that's why the report was sent out so much later, but the report was done so much sooner before the final language was created.
Yeah.
So somewhere, something doesn't, the time frames aren't adding up here.
No, let me see if
President
I can.
Frazier.
I think I can try to clarify for you. What I was explaining is that it was late in the session when we determined that we would actually move a technical bill forward. when we learned that there was some ambiguity or vagueness around whether or not the 7-day qualifying period would be paid for, the idea of the bill was, the intent was always for that 7-day period to be paid for. So then we decided, well, we have to move forward to make sure we have that clarification within the law. The studies had already been done. There were studies that captured 7-day period not paid. Studies that captured 7-day period paid. So those existed already. And then we learned of those as we were going through the process, and we were able to reference those to get to that 0.88 ultimately at the end. Again, Chair Baker, thank you, because that was helpful.
Thank you. Representative Macklin, follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I get what you're saying here, when was it determined that there was an ambiguity problem for the 7-day initial period?
Who are you asking the question to?
Representative Frazier.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Meekly, for the question. For me, when I came as the author of the bill, that was later in the session when I figured out that there was this ambiguity or vagueness about the 7 weeks. Seven days.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Okay. So it was later. I go back. Okay, so maybe this is a better way to ask the question. Who at DEED authorized the February and April studies?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, that would have been me in my office. I think we're just trying to kind of get around to this. I think we were, as we were kind of getting ready, bills were not introduced until late in the session. I think there were some kind of conversations about potential program changes that we had sought to model to ensure that we would be able to deliver timely actuarial products in time for the fiscal notes when they were requested, as the when the legislation was introduced later, as the legislation was introduced.
Thank you. All right. Anything follow?
Just a brief comment. So if I'm understanding this correct, you went ahead and ordered new actuarial studies in February and April based on speculative information that you were making assumptions that would be coming out later in session. I think that's what I got out of this. Thank you.
All right. So, again, I think that we've had a really robust conversation today about the importance of this bill that is, again, we've heard there was transformational changes in the authorship of the bill over the last couple of years. And thank you, Representative Frazier, for picking it up. It's a big bill. I have enjoyed visiting with you about this, and I know that we're going to sit down and talk about some of the things about this as well. I appreciate Director Larson coming forward and kind of helping us all understand who has a right to fiscal notes and who has a right, whether it's official or unofficial. We have a right to know what our bills are doing. And in this case, if we're asking a lot of questions to the department about this particular paid family medical bill, we have to pay money out of the taxpayer funds that were set aside to set this up. Okay, it's important, but we also need to make sure that we aren't just being haphazardly throwing numbers at the department. Okay, I think that's important. That's a fair statement. But what I want to make sure we just sort of just get our expectations right. Tomorrow we're hearing House File 11. It's an attempt to talk about delaying this thing for a lot of reasons why we just asked a lot of questions about the uniquenesses about this bill. Again, there was changes in the policy and interpretations of the law that took place late last year or early last year. Actuarial studies are updating. We've got just a lot of questions now that local impact studies are being very public now. That is being shared with our folks out at home. It's $130 million a year as the counties, the school districts, townships, and others. That is now getting around their heads, too. They're understanding the gravity of what this will cost them, too. When I say them, it's both the county and the employees that will be paying this tax. So this is a $1.6 billion per year revenue stream to come in to pay for this tax program. And it's an important program. The paid family, I think that a lot of us really like this. I want to make sure that we all here understand. We want to make sure that we can do everything we can to make sure that moms and dads can have time with their kids. And when there's a medical issue, we need to talk about that. What I am finally able to do now in my unique position is to make sure we take the time to do this right. So tomorrow's bill talks about delaying it 1 year. I'm not talking about repealing it. I'm not talking about any of that. And so, again, I just want to say this, too, and I want to read this because everybody's getting 100 emails about the same letter. And I want to say this, and I'm not going to use a name, but I just want to say this because this should set it for everybody here. Minnesotans all deserve access to paid family leave. After 10 years of studying legislative debate, Minnesotans' program is drawing on the best practices from all around the country and the rest of the world. There is no reason to take away paid family leave as we are just about to see it fully implemented. Parents need to be with their new babies. We all need to be able to be out with serious illness or being with dying loved ones or to recover from an unexpected injury. Delaying or watering down the paid family bill would be cruel and unnecessary. Please do not interfere with this important and popular program. We all got these. We are getting them multiple times. And I want to thank all those for sharing that with us. What we're doing tomorrow is we want to make sure we get it right. We have the opportunity to look under the hood, me for the first time, that is has a voice at the table so that we can actually be heard. And so what we want to do is make sure that we don't just roll it out as is. We have not been working on this for 10 years. We've been working on it for 2 years with changes in authors, changes in interpretations. We don't even know the official rate isn't posted yet. It's not official yet. So my fear is I would rather if our best option as a committee, and again, we aren't passing anything off the House floor until we have support either way. If our best option is to pause it, then that's our pause. If it's not, then let's try to fix it and roll it out in 26 with something that everybody can live with. But this bill last year had 100% opposition from the GOP the last 2 years on the off the House floor. In fact, it had two DFL members that did not vote for your bill. I want to make sure that the public knows that. So there was not any involvement with our support in trying to set up this program in the last biennium in this very large program that we have to have time to do it right. And I want to thank my colleagues for getting this important issue to the table. I mean, if I give you that, that's important. Maybe we can do this. There's 10 other states, 12 other states that are doing this mandated program. Others are trying different iterations. Others are trying hybrid models. I offered a private option last year. It's probably not doable, but I want to understand that my desire this year, members, is to look under the hood and let's make sure that we've got the time. We talk to our local partners, our businesses, our small business, our counties, our school districts, everybody that will be affected by this, we have to bring to this table. And I want to get it right. So whether we can do it this year, fine. And if we have different changes to it, but I have heard so much about it's different to take on this burden from a small business to a large business. And I think we have to recognize some of those kind of discussions. So I look forward to that. Until the morning, I guess, members, I just want to say we'll see you all there. We have a very robust day today. We did reserve the room upstairs for later in the evening tomorrow if we go late. I want to make sure that we hear from everybody who wants to speak. Again, we're going to try to do about a two-minute limit if we can, but if it needs to, we're just not going to, like, cut it off. So, members, I hope this was helpful today to understand the gravity of what that we're in front of today. Our biggest lift this year is to look at something that has not rolled out yet. And as soon as it rolls out, it'll be much more challenging to try to make changes at that point. I want to thank Commissioner Rowe. I want to thank Deputy Larson, Director Larson, to be here today because this is our beginnings of our very busy week. That's why we're here 3 days a week, members. This is a lot of work. So with that, members, we are adjourned.